It is my great pleasure this morning to introduce the Right Honorable John Alderdice. You have a brief biography, but just a reminder of a few points. He was Speaker of the Northern Ireland Assembly, leader of the Alliance Party of Northern Ireland. He currently sits in the House of Lords as a Liberal Democrat and was, I believe, recently elected President of Liberal International. He's had an enormously distinguished career as a diplomat and politician, and I'll mention one or two highlights, but what makes him probably unique in the world of diplomacy at his level is his early training as a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. So he brings extraordinary insights, particularly to the problems of ethnic conflict, tribal conflict, religious conflict, and hatred that exists in so many of the most intractable problems around the world. He has played a central role in managing the conflict between Protestants, which he is, and Catholics in Northern Ireland. Of course, a conflict known as the Troubles that goes back, about 800 years or so. He was a key negotiator of the historic 1998 Belfast Agreement, the so-called Good Friday Peace Agreement, for which he and the other negotiators won the John F. Kennedy Profiles and Courage Award for their achievement. And he has had he has spoken extensively before psychiatric groups as well as political groups around the world, and as I said, is particularly insightful on the dynamics of humiliation and hatred that develop in many of these conflicts, and has ideas about what can be done about these terrible problems that continue to fuel some of the most challenging problems that we face around the globe. So it's my great pleasure to introduce John Alderdice. After he speaks, we will have a conversation with him. John.
Yes. Thanks very much. Thank you very much indeed, Elliot, and lovely to be here in this wonderful part of the world. And I'm afraid at home in Belfast it's a little bit gloomy and grey, not so much in terms of the politics, but just in terms of the weather. So very nice indeed to be with you. I was thinking a little about how to deal with the question today. And I could present an academic paper to you, but getting a sense of what Aspen is about and how we are looking at things here, I thought it might be more useful to address it almost like a relationship, because it seems to me that there's a very interesting, organic, thoughtful, reflective way of working here at Aspen, and I'd like to try to fit in with that rather than bring in something which is a little bit alien to it. So what I thought I would do would be to try to bring you along the kind of journey that I've been on for the last 35 years or so in Northern Ireland and elsewhere, because it might help you to understand a little bit why I've come to the sets of views that I have. And then we can have a conversation afterwards about some of the things that I've said or ignored or forgotten about or that are important to you that I haven't touched upon. All of us, when we're growing up, spend the first few years really beginning to be accustomed to ourselves and our relationships with those that are close to us and our family circle and so on. And it's a little bit later on, usually as we're coming into our teens, that we begin to think about the wider world. So we're very affected by what's going on in that wider world, especially if it's rather dramatic, if we're coming into it at a stage when there is something quite important. And I was coming into my early teens in the late 1960s, when, of course, there were very dramatic things happening here in the United States, in Europe, in Japan, and indeed in Ireland. And the key thing really was that people in minority and ethnic groups were beginning to make demands that their civil and political rights should be respected. And in each part of the world, that took a particular flavoring. In this part of the world, the color question was very important. In my part of the world, it was very much more the balance between Catholics and Protestants. not fundamentally because it was a theological or religious question, but because there were some people in Northern Ireland, a substantial minority of the population, who wanted Ireland to be united and separate from Britain, and they were very largely Catholic. And then there was a majority in the north, though not in the island as a whole, who wanted to be related with Britain, and they were called Unionists. They wanted to be related, to be united with the rest of the United Kingdom, and they were largely, though not exclusively, Protestant. And so when the question of civil and political rights came along in the mid to late 1960s, and people in the Catholic community came out to protest about discrimination and lack of respect for their tradition, and were accompanied in many cases by people in the Protestant community for a more liberal and progressive background, there was a reaction against that by more conservative and fundamentalist elements, and indeed that broke down into violence and into rioting. The police were unable to control the situation, the British Army were brought in, guns were brought out, and really over a relatively short period of time, the IRA, which had almost completely disappeared, was revitalized, the terrorist campaign started, and what none of us at that stage reckoned on, not just young teenagers like me, but sages who'd been around for a long time, nobody reckoned on it being a whole generation and more before we'd see an end coming to that. But that's what happened. Once violence starts, a whole new dynamic enters in. You can see it. If we have a discussion or a debate here, we can control it, we can explore it, we can reflect upon it. But if somebody hits somebody else, very quickly you'll line up for or against. The guy who was hit shouldn't have been hit. The guy who hit him had a point, and you'll split. And that's very much what happened in Northern Ireland. And it happens everywhere else. Once the violence starts, once a war breaks out, it becomes very difficult for people to be thoughtful and reflective. You're pressed, polarized into attitudes. And that's what happened in Northern Ireland. And for me, it was really a puzzle as to why this was the case. Because many of the explanations that were around at the time, socioeconomic explanations, particularly Marxian and leftist explanations about this being the later stages of a post-colonial development, really didn't seem to fit terribly well. I grew up in a Presbyterian manse. My father was, still is, though now retired, a Presbyterian minister. And every couple of weeks we would have people coming, missionaries and others from parts of the world where there was real poverty, in Africa and India and Latin America, and they would talk about the situation there. And I was very much aware that while Northern Ireland wasn't particularly well off, in larger terms, nobody was actually really poor in Northern Ireland. There was a welfare state. Everyone had a roof over their head. And yes, there were differences, though frankly much less than there are in the United States. There were very, very few people who were really wealthy in Northern Ireland, and very few people who were exceptionally poor. And also, it wasn't particularly the preserve of one side of the community. There were poor Protestants every bit as much as poor Catholics. I knew that because I would go round with my father visiting in the congregation, and there were some very poor people in the Protestant community as well. So there was this puzzle for me. Why do we tear our community apart? Because it doesn't actually make any of us any better off. John Hume very often says, an eye for an eye simply leaves everyone blind. It doesn't help anyone to see any more. And fighting over the situation and driving away investment and business doesn't make any of us better off. It simply shares the unemployment around more evenly. So it struck me at that stage that those kinds of analyses weren't really very impressive. I was also not terribly struck by the so-called realpolitik explanations, which said that people fundamentally did things and countries did things in their own best interests. And that's why they acted. That the United States acts in the world because of its best social and economic interest as it sees it, and other countries the same. And it seemed to me that one of the problems is that very often countries do things that are not in their own best interests, at least the way some of the rest of us would see it. And as I was growing up, I was also seeing many of my friends doing things that manifestly weren't in their own best interests. You know, you've seen friends who build up relationships, and you look at them and you say, that's crazy. That's only going to end in tears. And then one day they split and you say, thank goodness for that. And 2 months later, they're right back in the same kind of relationship all over again. Or somebody you know is quite bright, but they don't work very well for their examinations, and they don't do terribly well, and they come back and they say, next time I'm going to work really hard, and you think, I'm glad they've learned from that, and the next time it's exactly the same. So they're not doing something that's in their best interests. They're doing something that's not in their best interests, and they're not really learning from their experience. So that led me to thinking, there must be some other ways of understanding this at an individual level and at a community level that might help to make interventions which would be better. And I grew up at a time when everything was getting worse and worse and falling apart, terrible violence in the community, and where it was becoming increasingly difficult for Protestants and Catholics to remain friends or to be friends across the division there. Quite naturally and understandably, too, the responses of the government to the breakdown into violence were law and order responses. So the response was, here are people who are breaking the law, they are being violent, they have embarked on terrorism, that's dreadfully wrong, and therefore we must respond robustly to that. And if we can't take them to court and convict them for because of intimidation of jurors and other things, then we will involve ourselves in what we call executive detention, what you know as Guantanamo, basically. That we would take people into prison without them having to go through a court procedure because we knew, quotes, on the basis of intelligence, that they'd been involved in terrorist activity and so on. But it didn't work. In fact, not only did it not work, it made the situation massively worse. It acted as a recruiting sergeant for the IRA. And huge numbers of people, young people, got involved, not because of the primary problems alone, but because of the sense of outrage about how they were being dealt with. Not just because mistakes were made and innocent people were lifted, but also because there was a sense of injustice. And I have to say that many of the things that I watch going on now, I'm very troubled by. I'll come back to that later, because they're so redolent of what we experienced in Northern Ireland, and it took us many years to learn from that, that you can certainly implement security measures, and you can certainly contain things for a period of time. But our experience was it did not resolve the problem. Because fundamentally, the problem's not a law and order problem. It's a political problem. It is that some people believe that the way things are is not acceptable to them, and they're not prepared to, or they're not able to change it through what we would call the normal democratic means. Well, I decided to get involved in political life as a way of trying to change it, but my question was still how to understand this problem. And so I decided to go into psychiatry and psychoanalysis, because it seemed to me that there were some quite interesting explanations there and ways of intervening. Quite interesting explanations of why people did self-destructive, counterproductive things. And so I trained in medicine and psychiatry and then trained in psychoanalysis. And if I might very briefly try to sum up, and that's not an easy task, but sum up in a minute or so, what it seems to me analysis says. What it says is, first of all, when people behave in a way which is damaging or destructive or pathological in some fashion, of course you can see their behavior, you can observe that. And of course you can try to reinforce that by positive means or discourage it by punishment or negative reinforcement. But of course there's more to us than just behavior. All of us know that we think about things and that affects how we behave. And we feel things and that affects how we behave. And indeed, how we think affects how we feel. That affects how we behave. That feeds back into how we think. And of course, if it's a destructive kind of behavior or thinking, it becomes a vicious cycle. Depressing thoughts make people feel low, make them behave in a depressive, inhibited way, which makes them think even more depressively, and so on and so on. But that's not all there is to us. Because, of course, there are lots of thoughts that are around that we're not necessarily aware of. At the moment, if I'm fortunate, you might be thinking about what I'm talking about. But if I go on and on long enough, you'll begin to think about other things. I'll see it in your eyes. You know, you're thinking about what you did last night, or what you would like to have done last night but weren't able to, or what you'd like to do tonight, or the football match, or the Mexican election result, or whatever it happens to be, will come to your mind. And it's not something new that comes in. It's something that's around in your mind, but it comes up because your attention to me is removed. And so the thoughts that are there begin to come forward. You know, if, for example, you go back to your physics, it's a long time ago in some cases, not so long in other cases, but you'll know from your physics that there's a certain amount of pressure coming up into the bottom of your seat. If there wasn't that pressure coming up, you'd fall down, because there'd all just be the weight of your body on the seat. And that whole weight of your body is concentrated on the small amount of square area that's in contact with the seat. So the whole of your weight, almost, apart from a little bit on your feet, is actually going down through your bottom at the moment. And all the pressure that's coming up has got to equal that, otherwise you'll all collapse. The more I talk about that, the more you'll become aware of it. You'll begin to discover that there are other people around you starting to shift around in their seat a little bit as they're beginning to become aware of it. Not because it's new. All those sensations have been around. But you're not aware of them as long as I can keep your interest. If I focus your attention on it, then you'll become aware of it. Or if I'm boring, you will become aware of it. But it's there all the time. So in other words, there are things you're aware of and not aware of. Conscious and not conscious. And the things you're not conscious of can change the way you behave, even though you don't think too much about them. If you've got a dental appointment, it's amazing how you'll forget it. You won't think, I'm going to forget the dental appointment. But you will, quite often. That's why dentists book in so many more people than they're going to see, because a percentage of people just don't turn up. If they had a crate of champagne for everybody that turned up, there'd be more people would turn up. They wouldn't forget. But they forget because it's painful. It's not pleasant. And a part of us says, I'm not sure I really want to feel that. I'll do it some other time. Now, why do you do that? Because it's not pleasant. And because you have some experience in the past that tells you it's painful and unpleasant. It may be that everyone's told you how unpleasant it is. It may be that you've been and it's not really very pleasant. So the past experiences affect what happens now. And of course, we play around with those past experiences in all sorts of ways to keep the unpleasant bits away. Take the dentist again. If you take your child to the dentist, not much fun for you, not much fun for the child or the dentist. But when they come back home, you'll find they take their teddy bear and they go, bzzz, this won't hurt a bit, bzzz. So what are they doing? They're taking that unpleasant experience and they're trying to digest it or change it because they're no longer the one who's having nasty things done to them. They're the powerful one that is doing the nasty things. And it's better to feel you're powerful doing nasty things than impotent having nasty things done to you. That's one of the ways we keep unpleasant things out of our awareness. And how that is handled by mom or dad or the dentist or the people we live with, and what are they experiencing with, that affects how things are later on. And what psychoanalysis really tries to do is to take all of these kinds of things, thoughts, feelings, behavior, what's conscious, what's not conscious, what comes from the past as well as in the present, how we make unpleasant things from the past into unconscious things, and how the relationships we develop in our early life affect things later on. You know, you bump into somebody and immediately you have a reaction to them. You may like them a lot. You may think, I really don't like this person at all. And you know nothing about them. So it comes from previous people that you've met that had the same name or looked the same or talked the same or whatever. Now, when you try to take this and apply it then to the experiences of a community and try to find out how do the experiences of a community and its behavior now, how are they affected by its history and its background and how it's been treated? Well, that seems to me to open up a whole series of possibilities for the way that we conduct things. So let me go back to the Northern Ireland business. When you train in psychiatry or psychoanalysis or whatever, and you want to treat some patients, it's not very difficult. You simply put up a little brass plaque, put your certificates up on the wall, tell a few of your colleagues that you're open for business, and a few people will come along and ask for your help, and you build up a reputation and so on. And generally the patients will come along and say, got a bit of a problem, I'd like your help with it, and so they're amenable and available to you. What I find was, if you try to apply the same thing to political life, it's not so easy. I mean, if I just put up a brass plate to say, you know, John Alderdice, therapist to Northern Ireland, I'd be more likely to end up in the psychiatric hospital than applying the views of the psychiatric hospital, because of course that's not the way a community works. So what are the fundamental principles? Well, first of all, developing an understanding. Well, we think we've got some beginnings of that. then getting into conversation with the patient. So the patient's got to be prepared to be available, and you've got to build up a relationship. So how do you do that in political life? Well, first of all, you've got to get yourself into the political world. So I wrote around the various political parties, and I found one that had both Protestants and Catholics in it that was committed to trying to deal with the peace process, and I got myself involved in that. And then I discovered, as you usually do in such organizations, that unless you get to be the leader, you don't get an awful lot of say in what happens. So I made it my business to get to be the leader of the party. And that meant that I could use the press, because they would tend to publish a press statement if I put it out, or they would put it in the newspaper or broadcast an interview or whatever. And it also gave me an opportunity to meet with other party leaders, people who represented the key strands in the community, and also prime ministers and people like that who had the power to make a difference. Another thing that's important with a patient is you've got to get into a conversation with them. Now, it's very difficult if you've got a conflict to get people into conversation with each other. It really requires a huge amount of effort, because the first thing people say is, I'm not going to talk to him. Look what he's doing. Look what he did in the past. You can't trust him. He doesn't want peace. I want peace. He doesn't want peace. My violence is justifiable. His is bad violence. So there's all sorts of ways it's difficult to get them into talking. And it took years for us to try to construct a process in which even some of the people were talking with each other. But without that, you don't get very far. The first set of talks, it took us about 3 or 4 years of talking about talks in order to get some of the parties into discussions with each other. We started in 1987 with the conversations, and at that stage, the British and Irish governments were talking with each other. In fact, historically, they reached an agreement in 1985, which was absolutely key. But subsequent to that, the other parties weren't talking with each other. And of course, nobody really was talking with Sinn Féin and the Provisional IRA or the Loyalist paramilitaries, because they were completely outside of politics altogether. But what we find was that it took us a long time to construct a setting for talks to take place. You know, all sorts of arguments that you would regard as silly things, like, you know, what shape of table, and how often would we meet, and what kind of sparkling water would you have, and all these kinds of things. But they're really very, very important, because they're how people begin to enter into a relationship with each other. You know, if a fellow says to a girl, would you like to come out to dinner? It's not because he's looked at her and thought, you're terribly underfed, I think we should take you out. He's trying to build a relationship with her. He's trying to show he's attentive to her interests and her needs. He's trying to enter into some kind of contact with her. So similarly, all these practical things were ways of starting to build relationships in this network. And then when we got there, not focusing in on what would be a clever settlement. That's a disaster. All the time, I find, people would be writing letters to me. You know, we'd have whole filing cabinets of people who knew the solution to the Irish question. It's extraordinary how many people know the solution, especially outside of Ireland. It's almost as though they think that, you know, one day, Dr. Paisley and Gerry Adams are going to see my letter, and they're going to go, ah, why didn't we think of that in the first place? We could have sorted all of this out. It's like a patient comes along to me, and I say, I know your problem. Chapter 7 of this book, it has you down to a T. Take it away and read it. I say, this man's crazy. It's the whole process of taking people through the feelings and the thoughts and the difficulties in relationships and relieving the blocks in those relationships. Well, the idea of that first set of talks was really something like this. If we can get what we called in those days the constitutional politician, to agree with each other, it will create a broad center that will marginalize the people that have turned to violence. And nobody will be interested in that anymore. And I think you don't have to look very far to see those kinds of ideas being expressed in other parts of the world at the moment. We must focus on the people who don't involve themselves in terrorism and try to get them to agree, and that will marginalize all of these other people and put it away for good. Well, some of us were very, very committed to that. But it didn't work. We couldn't reach a settlement. And one of the reasons I think we couldn't was because those who were in the process were always saying to themselves, oh, well, it's all very well, but if I sign up for this with my traditional enemies, these guys on the outside will paint me as a traitor. They will always be able to be there saying, ah, you see, you fell for it.
You've betrayed your own people to the traditional enemies, and they're not trustworthy, and they'll let you down, and in the end, they would be destroyed. And there's a very good history of that in Northern Ireland, on both the Unionist side and the Nationalist side, of people who went into discussions to try to reach an agreement, and when they settled, they didn't benefit from it. They lost out. And the people who were on the extremes were the ones who took it up and benefited from it. Well, anyway, for whatever the reasons, it didn't work, and we started on a new process in the early 1990s. And this had a very radical notion to it. The idea was that everybody would be able to be included, that there would be effectively a seat at the table for everybody, even those who'd been involved in terrorism. In fact, it was actually critical that they were involved. And the whole process prior to the next set of talks was really about how you got those involved in terrorism to come to a point where they would set the violence to the side. In principle, permanently, but frankly, there's not very much in life that's permanent. Everything, I think most of us realize, is temporary or provisional. But to try to press people to give the violence up for as long as was possible, on the basis that if they did so, they could then become part of the process that everyone else was involved with. And I'll not go into all the details of that, although we can talk about it later if you wish. But there was a lot of work, huge amount of work, and the United States became extremely important in that area of work, particularly President Clinton and George Mitchell, who, as you know, was his envoy. And they became very important for two reasons. First of all, because there are many people in the United States of America who regard themselves as Irish Americans, especially on the 17th of March, but at other times as well. In fact, in Ireland, we say that there are lots of people in America who will do anything for Ireland. Anything except live in Ireland, that is, of course. But they will do anything for Ireland. And it's terribly important because of that historic link to involve Irish America. Because it can be an encouragement for good, or it can be an encouragement for people to foment conflict. And what President Clinton did when he appointed George Mitchell was to say, we really believe that there's a possibility of going down a process that can lead to a resolution of this problem. And we believe that everybody can be involved. And you'll recall that President Clinton allowed Gerry Adams to come to New York at a time when nobody in Sinn Féin was able to get a visa. And it was a very difficult time. There was a lot of unhappiness about it. The British government wasn't very happy about it. The five leaders that were invited, myself, Gerry Adams, John Hume, Ian Paisley, and Jim Molyneux, the Unionist leader, the Unionists just absolutely refused to go. And so when we went there, their seats were empty, as it were. But it was a very important sign because it was an indication to the IRA and to Republicans that a door could be opened if they were prepared to give a little bit. And I think that began slowly to feed back, that there was an alternative to terrorism and violence. As I began to get to know more of those who had been involved in the IRA and in Sinn Féin, and there's a huge overlap between the organizations, of course, and those in loyalism, a number of things became clear to me. The first thing that became clear was this was a range of people. The idea that these were mad, these were criminals, they were psychotic, this is nonsense. Of course there's some people involved in terrorism who would be involved in criminality anyway. You can't run a terrorist campaign without crime. You need a lot of money, you need it from illegal sources, you need all sorts of things, weapons and so on. You can't just go and buy it over the counter. So you have people who are involved in crime, of course. That's not the fundamental purpose of the exercise. It's also clear that there were some people who did get involved for personal reasons. You know, people who had experienced their own humiliations or disrespects. I think one young man who got involved, and he was on the Protestant side, and his mother had become pregnant through a relationship with a Catholic fellow who then dumped her. And he grew up in the Protestant community known as a local Catholic bastard. And so he ended up joining a paramilitary organization to go out and kill Catholics. Because of that, you can see very easily, it doesn't take an analyst to tell you that there's a connection there between what he did later and what happened to him earlier. And perhaps one of the most moving things in the talks was when Martin McGuinness started talking about what he really, really wanted to do when he was a little boy. He wanted to be a motor mechanic. More than anything else, he wanted to fix cars. And when he was 16 and he had finished up at school, because he didn't go on to do his later exams, he went to the local garage and he said, "I'd like a job." And the guy said, "Don't have a job for you, son." He said, "No, I understand you might not have a job, but just, you know, keep me in mind. And when a job comes up, you know," he says, "look, son, you don't understand. I'm never going to employ you. You're a Catholic." But that wasn't the really striking bit. The really striking bit was when Martin McGuinness said, "You know, I sometimes wonder if I'd got that job, would I ever have got involved in all the things I got involved in subsequently?" Now, for a man who not only runs Sinn Féin but ran the IRA, that's a big statement, a very striking statement. And what does it say? It says that it's not about whether he got money for being employed as a mechanic that it would have kept him from getting involved in paramilitarism. It was the humiliation and the disrespect. That was what was absolutely critical. And that's the thing that kept coming back to me again and again as I would listen to people and talk with them and relate with them, an almost insatiable desire to be treated with respect. And once you start to say to people, "Okay, let's sit down and talk. Yes, I got some requirements, stop shooting me first, but then let's sit down and talk," then somehow that says you're worth listening to. I'm prepared to treat with you as another human being. I don't agree with you. I fundamentally disagree with you. But you know, we can have an argument and disagree fundamentally about all sorts of things and still remain friends. But if I humiliate you and disrespect you, you'll never forget that, even if we agree about all sorts of other things. And that really struck me. And as we get into talks and as we worked our way through all the difficulties, that business of patiently having to listen to the other one became hugely important. We didn't start talking about, you know, what was the outcome? What was the plan? We started talking about, what do you believe are the fundamental problems behind this conflict? And we didn't do it for a day. When we went through all those talks about talks, we agreed that we'd meet Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of every week, from morning right through till evening, month after month, year after year, until we would get something resolved. And the table would be available for everyone to come to who was not involved in violence at that time. And when George Mitchell came in, what you may or may not know is that when he chaired that, he would be chairing something where for hours and hours, traditional enemies would be listening to each other, just sitting there listening, not even necessarily intervening. I remember one particular unionist started talking, and he spoke for 5 hours without a break and without a note. And it was coming near to the evening time, and one of the nationalists intervened and said, "Senator Mitchell, I'd just like to ask whether we'll continue on to the completion of the presentation this evening or whether we take a break and resume with our colleague's presentation the next day." And so George Mitchell says, "Well, you know, let's take a break now and we'll resume the next." He went on for another 2 hours the next day. And then, after such presentations, everyone would cross-question the person who had presented. That might go on 2 days, 3 days, longer than that. Then the next person would make a presentation. There were 10 political parties involved, by the way. That's what the kind of involvement and commitment that was necessary. And even then, we didn't reach an agreement. In fact, by October 1993, George Mitchell said, "Now look, folks, I've been with you a long time. I've grown to like you very much. But I have a new wife. We've a little baby. I've been flying backwards and forwards across the Atlantic." He'd done more than 100 transatlantic return flights. And he said, I can stay with you till next Easter time. But then I'm going to need to spend some more time with my wife and little boy." And you know, everybody accepted that. They said, "This is reasonable. This guy has given us a lot of time. He's not saying you have to reach an agreement. He's not setting that kind of deadline. He's saying, look, a little bit down the line, I'm going to have to withdraw from the process." But we all knew that if George went, much of our prospects also went with him. And that's why it ended up being a Good Friday Agreement, was that months in advance, he'd warned us that that health-giving component, that patient listening to things, that enabling us to get through the hurdles, that was going to slip away, and with it many of our opportunities. But people accepted that kind of deadline, because they didn't feel it was being forced upon them. They felt it was fair and reasonable, and it was that person's actual expression of a commitment to us, not a withdrawal of commitment. Well, we got the agreement, as you know. You may want to pick up various things about it. It was an extraordinary agreement, quite unprecedented. Can you imagine a situation where, in California, for example, you would reach an arrangement whereby everybody who stood for election, if they got 10% of the votes, they would get 10% of the seats in the House, 10% of the chairmanships, 10% of the deputy chairmanships, and 10% of all the governmental positions. And by the way, there couldn't be a governor. There'd have to be a governor and a deputy governor, and one would have to be Hispanic and the other non-Hispanic. And they'd have to be elected on the slate together, and neither could make any decision without the other one agreeing to it. And any law that was going to be passed, if there was any sense that a minority of a significant kind felt disabused by this, then it would require that a majority in both communities, as well as the community as a whole, would have to sign on for it. Quite unprecedented, with the possible exception of Switzerland. But that was the requirement. Nobody was prepared to sign on for anything less than that. In a sense, it had all sorts of problems within it, but it also had opportunities. And so at that point, we'd in a sense reached the limit of what inter-party talks could do. And we had an election, and we were mandated by the people north and south of the border to put the institutions into place, an assembly that would involve people who'd been in democratic politics all their lives and people, some of whom had been involved in terrorism, together, some of them in ministerial positions. That there would be a north-south ministerial council where some of these people who were ministers in the north would meet with ministers in the south. An East-West Council where the British and Irish governments would meet, but also a larger one which would include the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Government, all of these components, all together, trying to reach understandings with each other. At that point, I decided, well, I think I've done what I can usefully do in my own little way in this. And I decided to step down from party politics. I'd been the leader of my party for 11 years at that stage. My beard was beginning to get a little grayer than it had been when I started. But the Prime Minister suggested that if I could perhaps act as Speaker for a little while, that might be a helpful thing. And so I was put into position as Speaker until an agreed Speaker would be found. That lasted 6 years because they didn't reach an agreement on trying to find any alternative. But what it did was it gave me an opportunity to try to construct a new kind of parliamentary assembly based on the kinds of principles we've been working at. For example, the fundamental importance of respect. So what's the really important thing for every doorkeeper, every attendant, everybody in that building who's serving the members of the assembly? They've got to know every member, know their name, and greet them in a respectful way. What's the important thing when we're running the chamber itself? That everybody acts in a respectful way. I can't expect Gerry Adams to feel respect for Ian Paisley or Ian Paisley to feel respect for Gerry Adams, but I can expect both of them to act with respect to the institution. And there were all sorts of ways that we were able to try to do that. Simple kinds of things. You can't tell people to do things. You can invite them. For example, a new language was going to be an issue. Quite a lot of the Republicans don't speak Irish. But if you were to say to them, you can't speak Irish, they'd get very angry. Some of them speak Irish extremely well. None of the unionists speak Irish or understand it. So what are we going to do? I thought, let's start with this principle of respect. So we started by saying, look, anyone can speak any language they wish in this assembly. However, since others may not understand the language you choose to speak, I'd ask out of courtesy, not command, out of courtesy, not because of a rule, that you make your own translation of what you say. And nobody could think of a reason why that wouldn't work. And so that's how we got over the language problem. And there were all sorts of ways in which if you could get people to just behave in a respect way, it starts to take the sting out of what seemed to me to be the huge problem of people feeling disrespected and humiliated. At this point, I came across some work, I was introduced to it, by a colleague in the United States, a man called Jim Gilligan, a psychiatrist who'd been working in institutions for the criminally insane on the eastern seaboard of this country, working with people who had murdered when they were psychotic. Incredibly disturbed people. And what was interesting sitting down and talking with him was exactly the same thing began to come forward. Almost all of these people believed themselves to have been hugely disrespected. And when they murdered someone, that person was standing for the person who had disrespected them. And when you started to work with that, the aggression began to diminish. And so did the psychosis. The tragedy was that a gubernatorial election came up. And one of the candidates said, oh, this is a nonsense business. These guys are living in a holiday camp. All this psychological nonsense. We're going to get rid of that nonsense. And they did. And the homicide and suicide rate soared back again the way it had been when it had got to a point where it had virtually disappeared. And as you know, it's rather high in a lot of the institutions in the United States, much higher than in Europe. But what that work confirmed in my mind was we were dealing with something that's fundamental to people. It's not just about politics. It is about politics, but it's fundamentally about people. Well, one problem remained for us. The Assembly actually worked very well, but the government kept breaking down because the IRA had said, we want our prisoners out, and the government and the unionists, the British government, the unionists, indeed the Irish government, who said, and we want the weapons dealt with. Well, the prisoners all got out, but the weapons didn't get dealt with. And that left unionists in particular, but others as well, feeling distrustful of the Republicans. And so David Trimble, who had said, okay, I'll move first, I'll go into government with you guys, but I'm trusting you to do something about this. When they didn't, his own people started to turn against him. And so he withdrew from government. And he went back in on the promise that this time it would be dealt with. And it wasn't. And his own people began to turn against him. And he went out again. And the third time he went back in, and still there wasn't any movement. And eventually, as you know, he lost position entirely and lost his seat in Westminster and so on. But during that period, we began to think, what can we do to address this? Do we turn back to the old repressive way of doing things? Do we demand that people do? Well, we can't. You can't make people give up weapons. You can request it. You can press for it. You can't make them. So there was a new kind of device created, a monitoring commission, which would be independent, somebody from the state, somebody from Britain, somebody from Ireland, somebody from Northern Ireland, who would have access to whatever information was available, and who would talk and publish reports about what the IRA was doing. Was it involved in criminal activity? Was it not? Had it weapons? Did it not? Was it making different changes? Were they not? And the Loyalists, and the dissident Republicans, and subsequently, by the way, the British Army, was it doing what was promised in terms of reducing down numbers of soldiers, reducing helicopter flights, reducing down the number of barracks and so on, and produce reports on these things? A monitoring exercise that would open up the light of day to lots of things that people tend to keep secret. You know what it's like? I think it's a bit like that in the States too. Once you say, this is an intelligence matter, this is a security matter, this is a matter of national security, that means nobody's allowed to talk about it. And actually, it doesn't usually solve the problem. Because the intelligence agencies do their best, but they're not perfect. They're human beings. They make mistakes. And sometimes they're also overprotective of the information that they have. And so as we worked and as we began to bring this kind of out into the open, because the sunshine and the sunlight's a really good disinfectant, as we began to bring it out into the open, things began to change. And as we were able to say, well, now we don't think actually Republicans are making enough effort, and therefore they shouldn't continue to get the full amount of public money that they're getting as members of the Assembly. And the Loyalists, the same. They should be making more effort too, and their money should be cut. And then if they begin to make more effort, their money should go back up again. But fundamentally, why are we doing this? Because there's still beatings and shootings and extortion and criminal activity and weapons. And what happened? Well, the IRA then had a huge decommissioning of weapons. Enormous amounts. Probably all the weapons that the leadership actually had control of. There may well have been some folks outside of that, I'm pretty sure there were, who said, well, stuff you, we're not going to give the weapons up. We've had them a long time. But the leadership certainly took the right moves. And the level of beatings and shootings, particularly on the Republican side, have gone right away down. And the situation's gradually improving. Now, it gets us to a point where I think the likelihood of going back to the terrorist campaign, is now at a very low level, not just because we've dealt with weapons, not just because we've dealt with prisoners, not just because of the assembly, but fundamentally because people in the nationalist community knew nothing can be done politically without them being at the table. Their views and their culture and they themselves have to be treated with respect. Well, in a sense, I kind of merged together two things there, because it's the question of long-term conflict and the question of the use of terrorism. And for me, in the last few years, the question has been this: how much of all of this is just to do with Ireland? And how much of it is applicable in other kinds of places? Because we were encouraged by the South African experience. It wasn't exactly the same, of course not. But there were some similarities. Nelson Mandela took quite an interest in our situation and got quite a lot of us to go out to South Africa on a number of occasions. And of course, at that point, Dr. Paisley's party wouldn't meet with Sinn Féin at all. So they had to set up separate places where there would be some of us who would be meeting with Sinn Féin and separate set of accommodation arrangements and restaurant and all for the DUP. And so and Mandela had to do two talks, one to Dr. Paisley's party, one to the rest of us. And he said, we'll do anything to help you because we know it's very difficult in circumstances like this. In fact, look, we've even reintroduced apartheid for the weekend just to help you out of your problem. And by bringing it forward in that kind of way, not waving his finger at us, but kind of making fun of it and yet understanding the significance and seriousness of it. One of the unionists came to me a little bit later. He said, you know, we've come thousands of miles to just replicate all this nonsense. I'm not going home to do this anymore. It did have an impact and an effect. And I began to think, well, let's try to see, is it the case in other places? Let me pick up just one or two places. I was invited to go and spend some time, and I've been backwards and forwards on a number of occasions, to Peru, where, as you know, they had a Maoist insurgency, the Shining Path, Sendero Luminoso. Now, the situation there is very different politically, economically, and in lots of other ways. But there's a minority of people of Spanish descent, about 20% of the population, who still basically control everything. And interestingly, they're not the first, because the Incas before them despised the local native people as well. So the Spanish really only took over where the Incas left off. But it was absolutely clear when I was there that the Quechua-speaking people and others up in the mountains, as well as the many, many people in Lima, they weren't just poor, they were disrespected. You didn't do things in the Quechua language, for example. And there were a whole lot of instances of it. It was very clear that there was this same kind of principle. And no matter how you batter down Sendero Luminoso, the things which were below it will come back up again. And it's not a question of a few bits of symbolism. Everybody thought when Toledo was elected as the president, and he came from a non-Spanish background, and he was very successful, he'd been to the United States, he was a good businessman, that would be a symbol to people. Well, it was. But he wasn't able to deliver the changes in society that were necessary. Because every time he tried to do so, he came up against the establishment in the military, in the police, in the courts, which wanted to keep things the same. So it's not surprising that in the recent Peruvian election, you see somebody coming forward, not winning the election, but having a very strong position, who's really much more radical, much more populist. And that won't go away. Or take another mountain part of the world, Nepal, which has also got a Maoist insurgency at the moment. That's not a post-colonial situation at all. Even at the height of the British Raj in India, Nepal was independent. There was a lot of cooperation. Soldiers came and fought in the British Army, still do, the Gurkhas. But in that country, there's a Maoist insurgency. Fighting against colonialism? No. But it's the world's only Hindu kingdom. And one of the things you will know about Hinduism is the caste system, which divides the community into everything from those at the top, the Brahmins and others, to the untouchables at the bottom. So there's a whole bunch of people there who feel we've got no auntie, nobody respects us, nobody treats us properly, and they don't. And the Royal Court and the Nepalese Army, recently the Royal Nepalese Army, but it's kind of changing a little bit, they come from the higher caste, particularly the officers anyway. And they don't have fellow feeling with people at the bottom of the heap. So the same kinds of principles that I found there again, this question of disrespect. You go to somewhere like South Africa or Israel-Palestine. It's slightly more complicated there because the people who are behaving or in the past, behaved with disrespect to some, had themselves been treated with disrespect. Where did the Boers come from? They came from Europe. They went out to the southern part of Africa because they were poor people who had been disrespected. And just like the little kid who'd been to the dentist with the teddy bear, they did to other people who they found there what had been done to them. And then the British went out and did it to them again. To the Boers, I mean. So this was really very deeply in. This business of people not treating others with respect. If things simply happened on a rational basis, you would expect that someone who had suffered seriously would make sure that others didn't suffer the way they did. That's why many people look at Israel at the moment and say, nobody in the world understands suffering better than the Jewish people. They had it for hundreds of years at the hands of most of us, culminating in a Holocaust. There's no way, surely, they, of all people, would treat other people badly. It's a fundamental part of us as human beings. It's not a behavioral question. It's a much deeper thing in us that we find ourselves treating other people badly often when we've had people treat us badly before. And it's incredibly counterproductive, but it doesn't stop us doing it. And the current strategies that are being adopted, they frighten me. Why? Because I've seen it in micro in Northern Ireland. And it took us 35, 40 years to learn that we had to do it differently. And we still have all the legacy of the hurt and difficulty and disrespect, and we're trying to overcome that. What really worries me is that if this is happening at a global level, not only you and I, but our kids are not going to see the other side of this. Terrorism does not go away because you batter it down. And the bit I find that I'd really like to press, the United States and the United Kingdom understood very well that when they were addressing the problems in South Africa, they had to ensure that everybody was treated with respect, even though the ANC had involved itself in terrorism. Not at a hugely high level, but nevertheless they had. But everybody knew that just because people had a past, they couldn't have a future. No. That was one of the things David Trimble said at the start of the Assembly in Northern Ireland in respect of the IRA. I'm not going to say that because people have had a past, they can't have a future. And we knew that in South Africa. And we knew that those who'd been at the wrong end of the stick and had taken to violence had to have a chance of something different. And both our countries understood this in Ireland. For a whole bunch of reasons we understood it. And we're perfectly prepared to accept that someone like Martin McGuinness is going to be a leading figure in government. And who knows, but Gerry Adams might not be a leading figure in the Irish government within the next 10 years. And yet we have a bit of a struggle about understanding that the same thing may be true about other parts of the world where there's terrorism. That's why in the last year or so, I got myself involved in talks directly with Hezbollah and Hamas. And I heard all the same things that I've heard before. When I went there to meet them, I sometimes kind of wondered, was there some university that Sinn Féin and Hamas and so on had all been to? They learned all the same language, all the same approach, all the same sets of understandings. But it's not that. It is because you're dealing with some fundamental things about people. And one of the things that they said to me when we started talking in the early to middle part of last year was this. Don't misunderstand it. There are many of our young people who think we're wet moderates. They say, you're fools. Don't go down this democratic road standing for elections. The West doesn't believe in elections. Look at the allies of the West. It's Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Pakistan, where you have people in charge who are authoritarian. They're not democrats. They don't respect human rights. They control things and they keep things in the best interest of the West. Don't go down this democratic road because it won't be respected. Just because you get elected, they won't respect you. And many of these people in Hamas said, no. Actually, we believe this is the right way to go. And so we're going to stand for election. And we're going to try to make it a better place for our people. And we're going to look after health and welfare and education. We're going to get rid of corruption. And we're going to try. And if there's a peace process that's possible, if anybody wants to do business with us, then we're open for business. I said, well, hang on a second. There was one requirement in Northern Ireland before any of us would sit down and talk. And it was a cessation of violence. They said, yeah. And we're prepared for a hudna, a cessation of violence. I said, okay, how long for? 6 months? 12 months? They said, no. 25 or 30 years. That's the length of time a talks process is going to take in this part of the world. There's no point in having a shorter one because it won't reach long enough. Okay. So that's on the record before the elections. And I could see the way the elections were going. I'd seen it before. I saw it in Iraq. And some of my colleagues were in discussions there, and we feeding back to people here in D.C. and people in London and saying, I'm sorry, your preferred candidate in Iraq is not going to win. And Fatah is not going to win. And the answer we got was, no, you have to be silly. You don't understand. We've done the opinion polls. We know. Well, they can do whatever opinion polls they like. The key opinion poll, as politicians, we always say, is the one that comes out in the ballot box. And there isn't any dispute that the election was a fair one. And if the message that we then send back is, no, democracy isn't just about voting, it's about getting the right result, then that's not going to be an acceptable message. It's not going to be a respectful message. And it's going to humiliate the very people we actually need to engage with. Because there's a whole generation of young people growing up in a crescent that extends from Morocco right through North Africa, through the Middle East, right down to Indonesia, where there are young people growing up with Islamist teachers who are saying to them, the West doesn't respect you, it despises you. And you should respond appropriately. So I feel here a sense of passion, yes, and of deep anxiety. Not because I don't believe there's a better way of doing things. A way that I feel conviction about because it's something we've worked at. But because, you know, and you've seen it in your own life with your own friends and colleagues, just because there's a better way of doing it doesn't mean you'll do it. Two young people don't get together and get married because they intend to get divorced. But it just happens. And it happens because people don't find ways of dealing with their past and with their feelings and with their relationships with each other. And at a global level, it's just the same. Well, the problem about a combination of passion and the genetics of being the son of a Presbyterian minister means that I could go on forever. And I won't. I'm going to stop at this stage because I hope there's a little bit of time for us to have some conversation. Thank you very much. Do we have a microphone?
There is a microphone in the middle. I'm not sure unless you can speak very loud.
I think we're all searching for the application of what you said to the conflict with radical Islam. And there's one part of the story of Northern Ireland that I missed, and that is how did these people come to the decision that they would give up violence? Because we cannot talk to Osama bin Laden because he's not willing to give up violence. And the Israelis cannot talk to the radical wing of Hamas because they are not willing to give up violence. They're off in Syria and they want to keep this going. So the question is, what is the method? I mean, it sounds as though exhaustion may have something to do with it, but I'm not sure. But how do you get over that hurdle?
Okay. There were a number of bits to it. On the side of those who were involved in the violence, there was an important human element. And one can lose sight of the fact that people who get involved in terrorism are human beings. And some of these people now had children who were the same age that they were when they started the Provisional IRA. And they started saying to themselves, do I want my kids to do this? Do I want my kids to follow me? Because if they do, they'll probably end up dead. And if they only get as much success as I have had, well, that's not really going to be much of a return. So I think we should try a different way. And the second thing was there was an exhaustion on the side of the British government and the British Army. The British Army for years had been saying to the British government, look, we can't win the war. We can contain it. We can hold the ring. If you're prepared to put money and people into it, we can probably even hold it indefinitely. But we can't solve the problem. And you've got to be prepared to start engaging with these people before they change their views and before the violence stops. And so the British government started a process of arm's length conversations behind the scenes, trying to point out what were the kinds of requirements that were there. And nobody said to the IRA, oh, by the way, you've got to change the Green Book. Now, the Green Book is a little bit like the Hamas Constitution. It's the one that says, you've got to get the Brits out, nothing else matters, anybody that defaults on that, shoot them, you know, basically. And if we'd started off saying, well, you've got to get rid of those ideas before we have talks, we'd never have talks. That was to be an outcome of the conversations, not a prerequisite. It's like trust. People say, we can't have a peace process because there's not enough trust. No. You have a peace process because there isn't trust. Trust is the outcome you're hoping for from the fact that you can't trust people. Trust comes when people reach agreements with each other and deliver on them. And then you say, oh, I'll try them a little bit for the next time then. So it wasn't just a question of a degree of exhaustion on one side. It was both sides believing that they could not deliver militarily, and both sides being prepared to start putting out feelers at very considerable risks privately. In fact, it's no secret that the British government at the level of the Prime Minister denied some of the things that were happening whenever they were happening, because it was so politically problematic. But in the end, people had to take risks. And I rather suspect, in the end, whichever government it is, how many more lives have to be lost for it, somewhere there will have to be some conversations.
Hi, I'd like another hour speech on your experience with Hamas, but that'll be later. Two questions. Would you speak to the specific problems of a religious conflict versus the other kinds, just a little more? And the second thing is, I'm at the United Nations, and one of the best seminars we ever had was with psychiatrists and psychologists and all the concepts, the good mother, the good, a lot of different things like that. What do you see among your peers in that field about them getting more involved in these kind of things? Because the only people that came to those seminars were the NGOs, not the diplomats.
Yeah. First of all, on the issue of religion, it's a very complex issue. But let me just make one or two remarks about it. The first is that those of us who come from an Enlightenment tradition have, in my view, made a very serious mistake over the last couple of hundred years. And the mistake was the view that religious faith was something that would disappear after a few generations of education. Whatever it is, it's much more fundamental to humanity than that. And it's not going away. And it's not going to go away. And the huge problem we have at the moment is that the three great Abrahamic faiths, which all come from the same kind of culture and root, by the way, the same root that psychoanalysis came from, can't find a way of living together. They all talk about being transcendent, and they can't even be human with each other. So there's some fundamental things that have to be dealt with and have to be understood and have to be worked out there. And that's a challenge to people from my professional background. It's a huge challenge to the diplomatic community and the political world. How to find a way of addressing these kinds of things, because much of politics has been about how do we deal with this politically and in terms of, you know, real tough, real politik, and all this other stuff, we either put it to the side or ignore it or whatever. The truth is these things are important, and not so that political forces can manipulate them, because then they lose credibility with their own believers and young people. So it's a complex, difficult thing. And of course, sometimes religion is a badge for something else. We're not having theological wars in Northern Ireland. But the badge, the cleavage line, falls along the same line as many other cultural and social and political divisions. So involvement of psychiatrists, and particularly psychoanalysts, from a biological background, see themselves as having no relevance. Those from a psychoanalytic background, prior to the Second World War, there was a lot of talk about this kind of thing. If you read a lot of Freud's later papers, he looked at this, he changed his whole view of the structure of the mind in the aftermath of the First World War, because he said, I can't ignore aggression as a fundamental thing. It's not just frustrated libido. The experience of the First World War is just too huge to ignore. But the experience of the Second World War, given how many people from the Jewish community were analysts, was such an incredible blow that many people just turned away from the outside world into their clinical world. And for the next 20 or 30 years, most psychoanalysts said, no, no, we don't get involved in the external world. It's just too awful. And it was interpreted as a retreat from the reality of the clinical world if you got involved in that. Now people are beginning to change their view, but it's a real struggle. And it's also a struggle to find out how do you intervene. Because as you say, if you bring along some psychiatrist, who's going to come? The NGOs will come, but not the politics. And that's why I got involved directly in politics. Because it seems to me the only way that you can bring that to the political field is to win your spurs in politics, take the hard knocks, be a politician. You won't get a load of votes for it, but if you get enough to put yourself in the position where you're at the table, then you can bring your views. You don't talk analytically, but you can bring your understanding.
They don't have the gifts that you do, most of them, I don't.
The gifts or the splits. Please.
Sir, one mini statement and a question. I want to thank you very, very much for so articulating so beautifully the lessons, the most important lessons that I've learned in the Middle East over the past 30 years. And I think the lessons that King Hussein learned that enabled him to play a unique role in bridging differences, drawing people together, and understanding those fundamental human needs that you have spoken about so well, that I still, in spite of what we're looking at today, and you referred to it briefly at the end, believe are the solution for the future, and the only way we'll achieve peace and security for any group in the Middle East. I have a small question. I often use, as an example, a statement of George Mitchell having credited women as having played a crucial role in achieving, in the process leading to the Good Friday Agreement, and that they were willing to stay when male members of their parties would walk out of negotiations, that the women persevered and stayed on playing a role of continuity and really a vision that transcended just short-term politics, a longer-term vision of what was in the best interests of their communities. Is that accurate? And I wanted to ask you to speak to that, if that makes any sense.
Well, a key part of the process was inclusivity. And that doesn't just mean involving all the different kinds of men. You know, it means involving the community as a whole. One of the difficulties I found as a political leader in Northern Ireland was, by the time I came along, persuading women to be involved in politics was actually very difficult because they said, this is a stupid boy's game. You know, this I'm not going to get involved. I'm going to get involved in building integrated schools or in running community groups or in doing things for the welfare of the community. And we'll do it on a cross-community basis, but don't expect me to get elected to Belfast City Hall. I mean, that will just drive me crazy. And so it was actually quite difficult to persuade women to get involved. It wasn't just a question of opening the doors. But many women then did start to get involved in various different kinds of ways, sometimes directly in political life and sometimes otherwise. And that did play an enormously important role. And one of the slightly encouraging things in some of the conversations in the Middle East is that the attitude to women, for example, in Hamas, is much more open than one might imagine and actually much more respectful than some of the governments that we have as allies. So the short answer to your question is yes, it's extremely important. It's part of the whole business of inclusivity. It brings a different dimension to things. And it's not a question of women good, men bad, or vice versa. It is that we all have to bring what we've got to the table, and there's a huge contribution to make. And the peace process did help that. And most people are very aware of the role that Mo Mollem as a woman Secretary of State played. Thanks.
Ariel Sharon and the Israelis had to do something, and whether they do it now or they'll do it later, there's 3 million people upon 3 million people, and they're too close, and too many things can happen to make it happen. We're so isolated and so ignorant and so arrogant because of our isolation. What do you see happening here in order to make things eventually happen? Because something has to happen. What do you see?
Let me take the same kind of principle that I've taken before, which is if it's an individual or a community or a group or a country let's try to understand the difficulties they have in the present in terms of how things were for them in their past. Now, the very simple reality is there is absolutely no prospect of any kind of resolution of things in the Middle East unless the people of Israel feel secure in whatever arrangement is made and the Palestinians feel secure in whatever arrangement is made. That's the bottom line. Whatever way it has to be got to, that's what it has to be got to. There is no solution to be found in undermining Israel or dismissing the Palestinians. But to take the main issue, which is, what do we as Americans do? I sense from Americans an enormous frustration that here they've got all this power and all this money and all these people, and they really, really, really want to be helpful. And all anybody wants is our checkbook. And they say, and then bugger off and leave us alone. And that's not good. So what is it that's going on? Well, I kind of think, what was it like when America came together? What is America? It's quite young, that's one thing. Teenage, maybe, rather than adolescent. Right. Now, what's the kind of story you get is something like, well, the old imperial powers of Europe, the Spanish, the French, the Brits, all wanted to get their finger in the pie, and they came over and they kind of fought over it. But a lot of thoughtful, good, committed, decent, democratic people here said, no, we're not going to have any more imperialism. And they founded a country that was based on freedom and opportunity and integrity in public administration. That's very interesting. What about the people that used to live here before you came? What about them? I kind of remember a bit about them because I used to watch cowboy and Indian films. And the cowboys all had names and families and ambitions and friends and hopes. And the Indians, they were just bad. They got killed. It really didn't matter. Nobody mourned too much about that. Whoa, that's another one. And those were people with names and families and wishes and views and philosophies of life. So what happened? Well, most of the people that came here because life wasn't terribly good where they were in the first place. Some of them fled from religious persecution, some from economic persecution. Some came from the Irish famine. Some came from religious persecution in different parts of Europe. So when people came here, they said, thank goodness we're away from all of that. Look at this wonderful country with loads of resources. And they did to the people they found here what had been done to them. And I'm not absolutely sure that the group mind of America has quite digested that and quite worked it through. And so when the U.S. cavalry comes to help, inside it brings something of the U.S. cavalry with it, which was about protecting beleaguered people against the Indians. And so when the American soldiers go out and say, we're going to attack you for your own good, it kind of doesn't really ring true. It's like sending the cavalry to an Indian village and saying, we're coming for your betterment. It doesn't quite ring true. And when the president then says, we're on a crusade, now he may be thinking Billy Graham, but that's not how it's understood in the Middle East. So my suggestion would be that America has a huge amount to give and gives a huge amount and sacrifices a great deal. But I think America's got some intellectual and emotional work to do as a country about itself that has to say something like, America's not perfect. It really wants to be good. It really can be an influence for good, but it is human. I was just reading one of the speeches from last year when somebody was speaking and they were saying, well, you know, there were all these empires in the past, and they all came and went, but America will live on forever. I'm sorry, you won't. America has a limited period of time as the greatest power the world has seen. But let me tell you, as a Brit who had the biggest empire the world has ever seen, that at least in the end we find a way of having a good relationship with most of the former colonies, and they want to be part of the Commonwealth. And your job as Americans is to understand yourselves, understand your history, appreciate the huge contribution you have to make, and maybe the limited time in which you have as a nation to make it, to make the history of the future a better one.
Thanks. This is very interesting. I wonder if you would elaborate a little bit on your discussions with Hamas and Hezbollah. I'm particularly interested in what goes on in the Middle East. You said that they understood that there had to be a cessation of violence, but how do you deal with a situation when a democratically elected entity refuses to abandon a platform that calls for the destruction of the State of Israel? How do you deal with that?
One of the things is that you need to understand exactly what people are saying. If you say to Hamas, do you accept Israel? They say, what exactly do you mean? I'm not being picky here. Do you mean Israel on the current boundaries? Do you mean Israel with the way it treats us? Do you mean Israel as it wants to be? Do you mean the fact that it exists, or the principle that we should acknowledge that it is right that it exists? Because these are all totally different things. If you're saying to me, are we prepared to recognize that Israel exists, that there are a large number of human beings there who have the right to exist without being abused, and that we've got to find some kind of way of living together? Yes. That's a different issue. But of course, it's reciprocal. Do they recognize our right to live and to exist and to govern ourselves and not get beaten up all the time? Do they recognize that? And where are the boundaries? What exactly are we talking about? So one of the things we learned in talks is it is really, really important to get to understanding what the person really means back of that. And most of these are thoughtful people. And that's one of the things that I would say to you is that as I've got involved with all sorts of folk in my own community and elsewhere, people who get to leadership positions really do represent something of their community. It's not by accident. Now, if you like the leadership of your country, then you can celebrate that. And if you don't like it, then you need to think about what it represents of your community. Not just say, I don't like it. It represents something in your community. I was never a supporter of Margaret Thatcher. I had to do business with her, but I was not a supporter. But she represented something of Britain. And that was really important to understand if you were going to do business with her, as well as understanding her personality. Now, what I would say is that whether you're dealing with people in my part of the world or in the Middle East or anywhere else, trying to understand what they're really saying back of this and helping them to explore it and understand it as well. I don't believe that it was necessary for the IRA to accept the right of Northern Ireland to exist in perpetuity. They don't, they didn't, they never will. They will always want to change it. And they have the right to, democratically. Of course. But if you actually look at what was being said, that was not said in the last Hamas manifesto. That nobody here read the last Hamas manifesto. The newspapers were not coming out and publishing it and saying, well, isn't it very interesting that although it's in the Constitution, they didn't actually come out in the manifesto and call for that. And it wasn't just because, oh, goodness, we forgot to put it in. It was to try to send a message. But what happened? What happened was that in the council elections before that, 300 or 400 of the people who stood for election were arrested by the Israelis. Why? Because they stood for election. And yet some of those people and their colleagues still went out and stood for the Palestinian council elections and got elected. And then when there's trouble arises and we don't like it, we don't say, well, now we're going to have to sit down and do business here. I mean, if this country had said, well, we don't accept what the Soviets are doing, so we're just going to bomb them. Well, we'd all have been dead. But what they had to say was, we know these guys want to kill us. We know these guys want to get rid of us. And what we've got to do is negotiate some kind of table around which we can actually talk. And Hamas are no angels. You know, let's not get to the view that you've got to get nice people with whom to do business. You don't have to do business with nice people. They're easy. And then they're going to cut off your money. What are you going to do? Well, we kind of do the best we can. A lot of the people are actually employed in security. We're fatter people anyway. And I said, yeah, you can't run away from it like that. Well, we'll do our best. But the United States is not the only place in the world with a checkbook. In other words, if you really, really want to drive Hamas into the arms of Iran, this is absolutely the right way to go about it. Hamas does not take the same religious views as the Shias in Iran. They are much more pluralist. They are much more prepared to accept that religion is a private matter for individuals. They do not want the Palestinian Authority to be run in the way that some people would like Iran to be run. But if you want to turn them from being nationalists who want a place for their people into religious fundamentalists, well, one good way of doing it is to starve them, because they'll have to look for a check from somewhere or other. And the money will find some kind of way of getting through. And it's very difficult. And I don't say that lightly, because I remember how long it took me to come to the view that I was going to have to talk to loyalists and Republicans. It's very, very difficult. It upends your whole way of viewing things. And that's really, really tough. And it's especially difficult if you're living in the middle of the violence. The guy who was asking there about how difficult it is when you're isolated from it. Yeah, let me tell you, it's even more difficult when you're not isolated from it, because the emotions are really hot.
Sorry.
Absolutely. So those who want to ask questions, if you want to grab the hold of me afterwards, we'll have a conversation then.
Okay. You spoke about how in predominantly Muslim countries, people often get sucked into terrorism by the view that there's a lack of respect from the West and the U.S. And how do you think that throughout the Muslim world, not just in hot spots like Iraq or Afghanistan, the U.S. and the West can demonstrate respect?
I think that there are lots of different ways one can try to do it. Let me give you one example. During the period of the Cold War, one area where there was clearly real interest and yet real divergence was in the area of nuclear physics, pretty obviously. And an organization was established called the World Federation of Scientists. It was set up by an Italian scientist, nuclear physicist, called Antonio Zucchi from Sicily. And they did lots of meetings with physicists of various kinds, brought them all together. But particularly, they wanted to bring physicists from the Soviet Union, the United States, UK, France, and so on together. And they did. To work not on politics, but on physics. And to work on nuclear physics and the bomb. You say, how could they work on the bomb? For goodness sake, they were trying to outwit each other. Yes. But there were two issues. First of all, scientists grow up in a world where you publish what you find as much as possible and you share that for the whole of the human race. That's kind of fundamental. And secondly, there are some things that they could work on, like what scientifically would be the result of a nuclear war. Let's start to map this out in detail. Exactly what would happen if you had this size of bomb delivered in that kind of way, how many people and how long would it last, and so on and so on. And they started doing this work together. And they started building up relationships with each other. And they started to trust each other a little bit. And then they started to feed back to the generals on both sides to say, look, you do understand. It's up to you. You make the decisions. But let me spell out in clear detail what we as scientists are going to tell you is going to happen. And they then started feeding it back to the politicians so that they really had to understand what they were doing. You know, it may seem a very heretical and shocking thing to say, but the longer I've gone on in politics, the more I've discovered how little most senior politicians understand about anything very much. Really, it's frightening. People are making fundamental decisions and they really don't understand many of the things they're making decisions about. Like, they're like investors putting money into areas of business they know nothing about. And that's nearly always a disaster. So the more it was possible to get scientists to think it through, they began to respect each other. They began to get respect from each other. They began to feed it back to the generals and the politicians. And it made a contribution. I don't say more than that, but it made a contribution to moving towards disarmament. What might be an analogy? Well, I've actually tried doing some work with the World Federation of Scientists, but it's a different kind of thing, the question of terrorism, because you can't say, well, let's get the Hamas scientists to come along, because the technology of terrorism is very, very different, and the structures are very different. But there are areas, for example, Islamists have begun to develop a whole Islamist approach to economics, which challenges Western approaches to capitalism. It's not socialism. It's a different kind of approach. Now, I suspect most people in the West don't even know about it, never mind any of its principles. But the kinds of things they say are, well, it's terribly important that individuals have a chance to do things, and business is the way of creating wealth, but there's also a society that we live in. And there are also sets of principles that we believe ought to be addressed. And that's part of our development. Now, one of the things that I and some colleagues are trying to do at the moment is to get some of those economists that we're most familiar with, and I'm unashamedly a liberal who's committed to the free market in all parts of the world, who's worked towards the development of the European Union and the development of freedom of the global market. But I'm trying to bring some of my colleagues into conversations with people who have a different understanding of how economics might work at a human level as well as at a market level. Because for me, there's nothing sacred about the market. What is important is the people who can be in the market. That's the thing that's important. It's the fact that people can be. It's not a market for companies. It's a market for people, that everybody can be involved. So there's a way in which we can start to say to these people, wait a minute, you've got something useful to say that we might be able to engage with and learn from. Let's start having some nice big conferences looking at our different views of economics. And there are lots of other areas where we could start to express some kind of respect for the fact that people from a different tradition have different ways of understanding. And that's not the same thing as saying everybody's right or everybody has as much light as everybody else. But it is a way of saying everybody has the right to have their views. And it's a challenge to me to look at my own views in the light of other people's, because I just might possibly learn something from them. Thank you very much. Yeah, sure.
I want to thank you for such a remarkable talk.
No, thank you very much.
It's fascinating. But I was wondering, in the answer to the first gentleman on the issue of getting the Hamas to come to the table, although they haven't found a